Bills. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. I understand that the attorneys are here and ready to argue our 10 o'clock case, and before we begin that, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. This appeal turns on no less than three pure legal questions that do not require this court to reweigh the evidence. First, whether Article 14.6 of the Montague Agreement erroneously awarded consequential or indirect damages. Second, whether Texas case law and this court's decision in Henry Preston prohibits the recovery of prior attorney's fees and litigation costs as damages in the second suit. And third, whether the appellee's full payment and satisfaction of the Montague judgment acted as a full bar to their damages in the second lawsuit. I'd like to start with Article 14.6. It bars special, consequential, and indirect damages. It's undisputed that the damages awarded were collateral losses in the form of prior attorney's fees and the amount a non-contracting party paid to satisfy the judgment to avoid foreclosure. We've defined consequential losses and direct losses in our briefing. This court is familiar with that standard, but I think the key here is consequential damages require the existence of some other fact, and here the type of damages that they got required relationships with their own attorneys, relationships that are outside of the contract, a prior lawsuit that involved, by their own admission, they say it didn't involve the contract issues that are at issue in this second case. And so for that reason, the first inquiry that this court must look at is whether 14.6 bars those damages. Now, what they've said in response to that argument is telling. They basically make two arguments. They say the operator appellee, Steelhead, had a duty to clear liens and defend that lawsuit. Well, guess what? Steelhead didn't recover any damages in this case, so that's out. The second argument they make is that Eagle Ridge was the party who had to pay the prior judgment to avoid this foreclosure. Apart from disagreeing with them on that point, Eagle Ridge was not even a party to this lawsuit, and Eagle Ridge made a decision instead of the decision to sue under this contract in the first place or bring those claims in that lawsuit. Eagle Ridge made the decision.
But wouldn't that have been a different venue?
Well, they've argued to you that venue prohibited those two suits, and we disagree with that. I believe that if they wanted those two suits in the same forum, they could have tried to get them in the same forum. There was a forum selection clause on the contract claims, but what they could have done, and they didn't try this, what they could have done is tried to get a first filed jurisdiction or move to transfer venue and have all these things heard. That's not what they did. They elected to fight the lien lawsuit in Montague County. They elected not to plead contractual defenses. They elected not to try to combine the two suits. And then their damage model in the second lawsuit was wholly based on attorney's fees that they incurred plus the amount of the judgment that they paid when they lost. From our perspective, that's the definition of consequential damages. It's one step removed from the direct contractual loss. There's no...
You don't think it's natural and foreseeable?
Natural and foreseeable. So foreseeability is certainly an element of proximate cause, and you have to show foreseeability to show either consequential damages. So when courts talk in terms of foreseeability, they talk in terms of consequential damages, and we've briefed that issue. There's several cases. The distinction I think we need to draw and that this court is going to have to decide is whether those losses were presumed as a direct loss that all the parties, when they entered into this contract, should anticipate. I think that's the standard. Did I answer your question, Your Honor? Second, even if these damages are consequential or direct, it doesn't matter. This court in Estate versus Preston set forth the standard, and it's very limited. It's an exception as to when attorney's fees can be awarded as damages. Now, we start with the principle under Texas law that attorney's fees and litigation costs are not recoverable as damages. This is not a suit for legal malpractice where an element of damage is some sort of fee disgorgement. That's important here. Instead, what they told the trial judge is, in a joint pretrial order, they agreed that Estate versus Preston was the standard for an equitable recovery of attorney's fees. Now, they've backed off that now. But they're wrong, because attorney's fees are generally not awarded as damages in Texas unless there's some exception. And here the exception is Estate versus Preston. It requires two things. It requires a lawsuit involving a third party, and it must involve tortious conduct. They can't meet either standard. So they've taken you down a different path. And they've cited to you a case called Guffey versus Clark. It's their lead case. Guffey has no precedential value. It was decided in 1997 when the appellate rules said opinions designated like that have no precedential value. The Dallas court has even had litigants cite Guffey to it recently, and we put this in our brief too, and it has said Guffey has no precedential value. So we start there. Their lead damage case doesn't have any precedential value, and this court has decided the exception to the rule, and we must follow it. Now, I would also urge you to look at the factual circumstances in Guffey. Guffey involved a settlement agreement where the parties were contemplating that, hey, we're trying to resolve litigation here, and we don't want any more litigation costs, including fees, and one party went out and breached that agreement. So necessarily, kind of like the fee disgorgement example or a contract between an attorney and a client, the fees are the element of damages. And here, the fees are not the element of damages. And that's why the exception applies in Estate versus Preston, and they can't meet that exception.
Okay, counsel. My questions are earlier than that. 4.3 of the Montague Agreement is where the lien protection kicks in. Both parties are arguing that their obligations vis-a-vis the lien based upon Montague Agreement, okay? How is it possible for there to be, for the lien, the or lien, to actually be covered by the Montague Agreement at all when it specifically says the operator shall pay, quote, as and when they become due and payable, okay, and keep the system free from liens, quote, resulting therefrom, okay? The operator here, as part of the Montague Agreement, couldn't keep it clear because it wasn't it became due and payable before the Montague Agreement even existed. How does the Montague Agreement even apply to the or lien? I mean, I know y'all are both arguing that. The problem is there's no actual language in the agreement that says, oh, by the way, this outstanding lien over here, we're contracting looking at that.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I think our position is a little more nuanced than that. I think our position in our briefing was that Steelhead was the party that had the obligation, but I agree with you that nothing in the agreement contemplates the Orlean that predated the Montague Agreement. And so our position has been that there can be no contractual violation on our part by even bringing this Orlean lawsuit that we acquired the rights to bring. And so the contract doesn't expressly cover that. We had no duty in that regard. They keep saying that we had a duty to not bring this Orlean lawsuit, but they can't point to anything specific in the agreement that creates that duty.
Why does CL not have a situation where there is an Orlean CL, which buys the Orlean and forecloses on the Orlean, but there's also a Montague Agreement CL, okay? And that Montague Agreement CL is obligated to some degree under the Montague Agreement to protect the interests of those within the agreement. So you're acting over here with regard to an independent situation that you've obtained by purchase.
Right.
But you're acting against yourself effectively.
So here's how I would try to articulate what the circumstances were here. So there's no doubt, Your Honor is correct. Steelhead, not CL3, was the party that had an obligation to invoice us for costs that it thought we owed and to keep the pipeline gathering system free of liens, right? So we all agree on that. It certainly says that. See, the operator Steelhead never, not one time, invoiced us or tried to get us to pay those costs until these lawsuits started. So they didn't believe that we had any independent obligation at that point. And furthermore, the evidence actually conclusively shows that when we sold out our interests in November of 17, the operator and its witnesses had to concede that we owed $0. So we didn't know anything under the Orlean, and what we had were these rights.
That would be true if the only liens that the Montague Agreement dealt with were prospective liens, prospective services, prospective debts. There's nothing in the agreement that deals with retrospective debt at all.
I would agree with that. I agree with you, Your Honor. And that's one of our position is that the Montague Agreement doesn't expressly obligate us, or prevent us is a better way of saying it, from acquiring this Orlean that predated the agreement and enforcing those rights. And that's what they have to show. And it also doesn't show any obligation on our part that we owed for those construction costs that predated the agreement. So I think we're more on the same page than...
Then I need another question answered, which is the order, the bankruptcy order specifically says, gives permission for the sale of the assets of the WBH operator.
Correct.
Or owner, okay? Those assets with regard to the pipeline are sold, but they're subject to the OR lien. The entire point of the OR lien in the bankruptcy proceeding was to WBH, which whether you're dealing with the affiliate or the owner, is trying to get a discharge from the OR lien. Is there anything in the record that reflects that the bankruptcy court effectively said, look, we're going to let you purchase these assets, but we're going to effectively say those assets have to be used to pay off this particular obligation of the bankruptcy estate?
We entered into the agreement with OR so that we could control that part of the debt. But the other part of the...
But you still had to get the trustee and the bankruptcy court to sign off on it, and it had to come in the form of an order, and I haven't seen anything in the briefing other than characterizations as to exactly what the bankruptcy court ordered other than the purchase of the assets.
So in the bankruptcy settlement agreement, which is the document that their witness said at trial, showed that we owed for the OR debt, that we were responsible for that, that we had assumed that liability, and that's PX24 Exhibit A. They pointed to that during trial. We asked the witness to show us any place in that document that shows that we assumed that obligation or that it was our sole responsibility. They couldn't do that. So that's number one. We've pointed out in our reply brief that actually PX31...
Just exactly who else could CL have gone after if you had agreed not to go after U.S. Energy and everybody else in this litigation that you're going after is a successor to U.S. Energy, okay? Then exactly how are you going to go after anybody to pay off that lien?
And that's the exact argument they made in the Montague court, and they raised those issues in their pleadings, and they lost on summary judgment, and they lost that argument that we owed the liability for that OR debt, and the Montague court found in its final judgment that they owed, that their interests under the OR lien, our pursuit of the OR lien claim was valid and enforceable. And those arguments that were interjected in the question, that's the arguments they're making to you again. Those were already litigated, and they chose to dismiss their appeal. And that gets us to this voluntary payment rule. You cannot pay a judgment, dismiss your appeal, and then turn around and try to collect that exact amount of money. The Supreme Court says that's barred, and it's Miga versus Jensen, which I'm sure this court is familiar with. And what they did here is here's how they've briefed it to you. They've said, no, we're allowed to do that because we were acting under duress. They weren't acting under duress because it was a court-approved foreclosure sale. We had a valid right to pursue that foreclosure sale, and there's legions of case law that support that proposition. I've cited three or four in my reply brief to you. It's this duress is not caused by a court-approved foreclosure sale being set. Now, they also don't fall under the MEGA exception to the voluntary payment rule for another reason. They've said they pay it under protest, but they turned around and dismissed their appeal. They didn't pursue the underlying appeal in the Montague suit, so they can't meet the MEGA exception. I think the voluntary payment rule is an extraordinarily strong position for us. It shows that they have done exactly what the Supreme Court says they can't do. You cannot pay a judgment, dismiss your appeal, and then turn around and go back to the courts and seek the exact measure of damage. We would have this happening in every case. So I'm not sure I have any more time.
That they asserted payment as an affirmative defense in Montague County. Did they assert a release of the lien? The validity of the lien was in question with regard to the foreclosure, correct?
Correct. I believe that's correct.
Therefore, to avoid the lien, there had to be defenses asserted with regard to the lien, payment being one. Did they assert release?
I would have to check on that. I don't know as I stand here. I believe they did. They asserted a whole host of defenses. But the bottom line with voluntary payment is they paid under protest, and then they dismissed their appeal in this court unequivocally. And that ends the inquiry. It moots that entire controversy. Everything that was raised in the Montague suit is over with and can't be relitigated here. And their damages are part of that. That's their only damage model.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry for going over time answering the question.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin with Justice Birdwell's question. There is a provision, 10.6, in the Montague Agreement that requires the parties to pay their individual debts, but it's their sole obligation, and it specifically lists the costs for construction.
What that cost in 10.6 gives you any indication that deals with retrospective debt? The agreement is signed, it's going forward. What about the language in 10.6 says, oh, if you owe something that's a debt with regard to previous construction or anything of that nature, then that's your own debt under the circumstances?
The debt becomes relevant when it's asserted against the pipeline, and that's exactly what CO3 did. And if I can put this in context, U.S. Energy and CO3's predecessor agreed to build a pipeline. U.S. Energy paid, CO3's predecessor didn't. CO3 was the hard money lender that basically was funding its predecessor and bought this pipeline on pennies on the dollar and bought it under the condition of two bankruptcy order. One was a settlement agreement in which they agreed not to assert any prior debts of its predecessor against U.S. Energy, and that it agreed to buy it subject to the lien. And as you pointed out correctly, they were the sole responsible party for it. The breach came when, after they signed the pipeline agreement, and by the way, they signed the pipeline agreement before they settled with Orr, and took on all those obligations to protect the pipeline, including not to put any unpermitted liens, which are defined as those liens that may put a co-owner's interest in danger of foreclosure or forfeiture or sale.
But that's an existing lien.
It's an existing lien.
It's not a lien going forward, which is what's anticipated by the agreement,
which the operator has a duty to pay. And the way this process works is the operator pays it, and then he goes back to the owners and says, who owes this money? And the evidence at trial showed that my client had paid all of the money. The original invoice that the parties received said it's a $3 million pipeline construction project. You got an AFE, an authorization for expenditure. And the evidence at trial showed my client paid 100% of those debts. It also showed there was no evidence of payment of this by CO3 or its predecessor. So once this lien is asserted improperly by CO3 and the operator defends it, once it pays it, it has to go back and charge it against the owner who hasn't paid their share. It says 50-50. Let's see. U.S. Energy, you've paid your entire share. CO3, you haven't. This is now a chargeable debt to you because of, and when the pipeline operating agreement was signed, it was an ongoing pipeline with a duty to pay all the costs associated with it, regardless of when the lien was asserted. Those liens didn't disappear. They were not eliminated by the bankruptcy court. They were an ongoing, continuing lien that the operator had a duty to prevent from being foreclosed on a multimillion-dollar pipeline and all of the revenue in it.
Did Orr file a lien specifically against WBH?
Yes.
And it identified WBH as the only debtor with regard to
And in the bankruptcy, excellent point, in the bankruptcy only went against Steel 3. At that point, Strategic had already become the operator, but he went only against Steel 3 as the sole debtor for that liability. And the reason the Monte County lawsuit, the damages we paid there in the form of a judgment, the legal fees that we paid there to defend against the pipeline became necessary, is because Steel 3 bought the litigation. It didn't buy the lien. It bought the litigation and asserted it against an ongoing pipeline in violation of a contract that it had already signed saying, I will pay my debts. I will pay the $413,000 that I bought the pipeline subject to my predecessor's debt. I will pay that as my sole debt, and I promise not to put any impermissible liens. And the contract specifically allowed my client to recover those debts under Section 9.2, which says that each system owner shall bear its respective participating interests of the costs and expenses attributable to the ownership and operation of the pipeline, and it lists which direct costs are reimbursable. It refers to Exhibit C of the Montague Agreement. Section 2, subsection 9 of that Exhibit C specifically lists those damages as legal expenses and costs of handling litigation, claims, and liens incurred from or resulting from operations under this agreement or necessary to protect or recover the joint property. In other words, necessary to protect the pipeline. Those were costs that are direct damages because they're specifically listed as the contract. And Section 10.3 says if a party defaults in paying its responsibilities under this contract, the non-defaulting party has a right to bring a lawsuit against them and recover all of those fees. They cite In re Preston, and In re Preston is frankly irrelevant because those are cases that deal with parties that didn't have a specific contractual provision that allowed them to recover these fees in the contract. We also have Section 10.4 in this case that allows the recovery of legal fees for any action related to the performance under this contract. That, in addition, allows us the recovery of legal fees in Monteague County. In re Preston was a probate case in which there was no finding that anybody owed legal fees, but it listed two equitable principles in a case where the contract didn't allow for the recovery of attorney's fees. The court said, it first cited the Turner case and said, if there a plaintiff was forced into litigation with a third party as a result of the defendant's tort, those legal fees are direct recoverable damages. And then it listed the second test. It also said after Turner, several courts recognize the existence of that equitable principle that attorney's fees may be recoverable where a party was forced to prosecute or defend the previous suit as a result of defendant's wrongful conduct. No requirement for a third party. That is exactly the holding of Guffey. They also signed Lessiger.
How did the ore debt still exist to be purchased by CL after entering into the Montague Agreement? Was the bankruptcy proceeding done?
No.
How did the ore debt, which was asserted as a debt against the bankruptcy estate, continue to exist in such a manner as that it could be purchased from ore? Because that means ore could have foreclosed.
And if it did, we wouldn't be here. There was a competing lien on WBH's interest in the pipeline. The first lien was by us because they weren't paying. Apparently, we were paying our vendor fees, and CO3 wasn't providing them enough money, so they were using our money to pay some vendors and not others. And therefore, under the contract, because we're permitted to put a lien on their property, we said we have a priority lien. CO3 said, well, I'm their lender. I have a lien. And CO3 said, well, I'm a vendor who wasn't paid. I have a lien. The parties were fighting, and at the end of the day, what CO3 attempted to do in the bankruptcy is to say, under the contract, my client have to pay a co-owner's debt. Their lien is superior, so therefore, once we pay their debt, they get to take it, and we disagreed. Ultimately, we reached a settlement where we said, the ore lien survives. The ore lien will survive bankruptcy, and you will no longer claim that U.S. Energy owes that port of the expense. And in exchange, we'll allow you to buy it without saying that we have any lien on it either. So the express, the bankruptcy court, number one, entered an order approving that settlement, saying they're not going to make any more claims. Buy the assets. Allow them to buy the assets and also allow the ore lien to survive.
Okay.
It allowed them to buy the Orlean, they allowed them to buy the pipeline expressly subject to the Orlean. In other words, the duty to pay it off. So the Orlean could then have been asserted against the pipeline. At the time, in the bankruptcy, was still being asserted against CO3, and CO3, without telling my client, without telling the operator, held a quiet, secret settlement agreement, paid only $350,000, and then immediately sued my client after signing the Montague agreement, asking for $413,000, more than they actually paid. And during the trial court, in questions by the judge, it was an interesting part of the trial, the judge asked these questions. This wasn't cross-examination. Luke Beltnick, their president, admitted, I did it as a bargaining position. I did it as a negotiating tactic to force you to pay this off because I knew there was a multi-million dollar pipeline at issue, and $413,000, you'd probably pay it. The court also held as there was personal animus between the parties because they had this fight since the bankruptcy court. So the Orlean survived. The bankruptcy court said U.S. Energy isn't responsible based on their settlement. It also allowed the allowed the Orlean to survive and allowed it to be asserted. And again, if Orr had asserted this lien, it had a perfect right to do it. And what would have happened is the operator would have paid it and then charged it back to CO3 because it bought the lien subject to the pre-existing debts. What it did instead was it took its debt, sued my client, and tried to encumber just my client's interest in an attempt to get my client to pay their debt. And the trial court properly found under Section 9.2 that's a breach of the Montague Agreement because they didn't pay their share. And as far as the issue that he brought up, that they didn't get an invoice, frankly, that's a red herring because at the time you only have to send an invoice once. The Orlean and the foreclosure suit was a contingent liability. Until it was paid, no one was charged. The contract specifically allowed my clients to recover the attorney's fees in defending the pipeline against a foreclosure. But until we had to pay off the judgment, the Orr judgment payment was a contingent liability. It took 4 years for CO3 to get it right. They sued the wrong owner. They sued the wrong easements. They tried to sue under the easements that surrounded the wellheads, not the easements around the pipeline. And even after we told them the right owner, the right easements, they kept U.S. Energy in there. They kept the operator in there, who frankly had nothing to do with this. And after they sold the pipeline to Eagle Ridge Energy, they sued their buyer as the current owner without releasing any of the parties, which is why this took 4 years, two lawsuits. And we tried, by the way, to bring that lawsuit or that issue before the Montague County Court. We told the Montague County Court that they had an independent contract to pay these fees, and the court found it had no jurisdiction and issued an order dismissing that request on summary judgment. For that reason, because a mandatory venue provision requires the Montague County suit to be filed in this county where the real estate, the easements were located, that suit had to be filed in Montague County, and we had a mandatory venue provision in Tarrant County, which is why we were forced to bring it here. They also argue that the fee, that there was prohibition that for somehow we voluntarily paid the Orlean and therefore the recovery of the judgment in Montague County shouldn't be recoverable. That is also a red herring. There is no more probable direct damage to paying that judgment than for my co-party, the person that we have a duty of acting in good faith in paying their share of the costs, in not putting an impermissible lien. When they bring that lawsuit against our co-interest and try to encumber just our co-interest, there is no more probable damage than trying to stop that lawsuit. And when the judgment was issued, CO3 didn't own that property anymore. Eagle Ridge did. So there's no reason to send them an invoice. But more importantly, that was exactly the kind of damage that Exhibit C, that's referenced in Section 9.2, claims that is directly recoverable. That is a directly recoverable suit. The damages for protecting the pipeline against the lien are directly chargeable against the parties, and because that was brought by them in violation of the agreement, that was a direct damage. And under Section 10.3, as a defaulting party, we were allowed to bring that lawsuit and to protect the foreclosure and then recover the direct damages. Had we appealed the Montague County lawsuit, there would have been no point to it. We filed a protest letter because the no point would have been The Monte County judgment was a prerequisite for ratifying the lien, but that's my word. But he basically had to find, was the lien properly filed? In other words, was the debt legitimate? No one denied that its predecessor hadn't paid $413,000. And second, did it encumber the correct easements? Well, we spent 4 years getting them there, but they identified the correct easements. So the only thing that could have been appealed was, did it encumber the proper easements, and was it for the proper amount? That wasn't an issue. The only issue was, this was the wrong party to bring that lawsuit. So stopping that by paying the judgment, the appeal would have made no difference, and we frankly reduced the amount of cost that the parties incurred by simply continuing with the Tarrant County lawsuit and saying this is an additional direct damage. There was nothing consequential about this. I finally like to address the last point, which is they seem to make an argument in their briefs that the mere fact that you have attorney's fees that are greater than the damages is somehow Texas law and unrecoverable. That's wrong as a matter of law. I'd like to cite the quote to Metroplex Mailing Services versus R.R. Donnelly, and that's 410 Southwest 3rd, 889. And in that case, the fees were 13 times the actual damages. The defendant there didn't challenge the individual invoices proving up the legal fees, and it didn't challenge the evidence. And the court held there is no rule saying fees can't exceed damages. In fact, the direct quote from the court is, indeed, the amount awarded in attorney's fees can greatly exceed the amount of damages recovered. And in that case, the evidence showed that there were detailed invoices justifying the work. There was factual sufficiency to support it. The cases they cite are ones where it's a single motion for summary judgment case and the lawyers overworked the case, or where lawyers guessed at what the hours were, and the court found the evidence was insufficient. In this case, the trial court held a separate hearing, a separate one-day hearing to consider nothing but the attorney's fees. And in that hearing, this is a abuse of discretion standard. The trial court considered the factual evidence to support the invoices, the legal fees. The trial court was in the best position to make that determination. And importantly, CL3 doesn't challenge the sufficiency of that evidence. The only thing that the review of this court is whether there was at least, there was less than a scintilla of evidence to support the legal fees. That's it. If there was more than a scintilla of evidence, if the evidence support these legal fees, then the trial court's discretion shouldn't be overturned. And the trial court, again, in a separate hearing, found there were two different trials, two different courts. We presented detailed invoices of the work done by the lawyers. We broke it down per party, per lawsuit, per time period of ownership. We had expert testimony and an extensive cross-examination of Mr. Berg. There was fact witness testimony on the invoices and the reasonableness. The court considered that this really wasn't a $413,000 case. It was to protect a multi-million dollar pipeline from being foreclosed. It was six parties, 4 years of litigation, and the fact that CO3 sued the wrong parties and then wouldn't release them when the proper parties were identified. And then it sold the pipeline, agreed to assign all of its interest, and we assigned both the contract and our interest in it and the right to pursue it, and yet wouldn't release anybody when he could have simply gone against the current owner. CO3 sold the pipeline, but he carved out a right to continue to pursue this lawsuit intentionally. There could be no more direct damages as a result. And the complex facts in this case, and you could see by the briefs, there's a lot of parties, there's a lot of easements, there are bankruptcy proceedings, there's two different trials and two different proceedings. And as the trial court held, there was personal animus between the parties that went back all the way to the bankruptcy court. Texas law rejects the excessiveness argument. Texas law rejects this argument that merely because attorney's fees are greater than the amount of damages, it can't be recovered. This goes back to the lawsuit where someone gets a 50-cent charge for using their ATM. They'd never bring a lawsuit. But the fact that the legal fees may exceed the right to recover against improper charges, that's a matter of Texas law. I will give the rest of my time back to the court, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
It's interesting that without me arguing about the $1.3 million in fees that the appellants stood up and spent the last 5 minutes of their argument saying we didn't challenge the excessiveness of the fees and trying to explain to you why $1.3 million in fees were awarded for a 2.5-day bench trial, because this case has always only been about them recovering fees. The damage amount was tiny compared to the attorney's fees awarded. And I think if you look at the cases, we did challenge the excessiveness on the proper standard, and this court can and should review those ratios, and we would ask you to remit a portion of their attorney's fees. And let me back up to the voluntary payment rule. You didn't hear anything about the voluntary payment rule. What they've said in their brief doesn't hold water. Again, the Texas Supreme Court has time after time after time said that you cannot pay a judgment, dismiss your appeal, and then circumvent the court system by relitigating those same issues. Their entire damage model is the amount they paid and spent defending the Montague lawsuit. So what did they argue to you in their brief? They said it was under duress. We had to do it. But they turned around and dismissed the underlying appellate rights. And if you look at Miga versus Jensen and Highland and the other cases we've cited to you, the law doesn't allow you to relitigate claims in that way. It simply doesn't allow it.
Claims or defenses that were dismissed for lack of jurisdiction?
They raised certain contract defenses, and the court found that the ones involving the bankruptcy, that it lacked jurisdiction, and so they couldn't bring those defenses. It didn't say anything about contractual defenses that they've raised.
Isn't that part of what we're arguing about here, is what in fact happened in the bankruptcy court with regard to the actual underlying debt? Because all the lien is the security interest with regard to the underlying debt. Whether that debt was discharged, whether it was handled in some way, shape, or form by the bankruptcy court.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I think we're on the same page. If you look at 9.2 and 10.6, they can't get there. So what did they do at trial? They said, you assumed this debt. You assumed these liabilities. But they couldn't. They couldn't point to anything, not anything in the bankruptcy documents. In our reply brief, we tried to lay it out as short and sweet as we could. Those documents are in the record. We did not assume the OR contract liability from the WBH operator. We simply didn't do it. And when we put the documents in front of their corporate representative's face at trial, he couldn't point to where we did. And that's the underpinning of their entire suit. Their whole suit rises and falls with this notion that we owed all the debt, they owed none of the debt, and that we somehow assumed the contractual liabilities through the bankruptcy. Well, the contractual liabilities through the bankruptcy, they haven't proven that to you. That's a different agreement. The Montague agreement does not.
Well, if you did not assume the debt in the bankruptcy settlement agreement, and the court was essentially saying that the trust itself had no obligation to pay that debt, then who owed the debt?
The Montague court said that they owed their share of the debt.
I'm talking about who did the bankruptcy court anticipate owed the debt?
I can't answer that. What they have alleged
that would be the thing that the Montague court didn't have the jurisdiction to decide.
The Montague court had before it these same WBH bankruptcy defenses. If you look at their pleadings, they're in the record. How they answered this. The Montague lawsuit was they asserted the same thing. They said, you stepped in the shoes of WBH. You assumed that OR debt. Those issues were ruled against him. That's the issues that I say can't be relitigated. But the main issue that can't be relitigated is they can't pay a judgment and then turn around and sue us for the exact same amount after they've dismissed their appeal. And it's black letter law. And they haven't argued anything different to you except duress. And the duress argument doesn't work. And so I'm just trying to ensure that the court is steered back to this Miga versus Jensen exception that they keep.
Let me ask you this. Let's say you didn't, after entering the Montague agreement, you didn't purchase the lien, the debt, okay? And or decided to enforce its lien and file the foreclosure action in Montague County. What were your obligations at that point in time under the Montague agreement vis-a-vis trying to avoid the foreclosure on your oil and gas transport pipeline?
I think, as we've said in our brief, the short answer is that Steelhead was the operator and it was the only party with a duty to resolve liens. We were a co-owner. If those liens were, it's a hypothetical, but if those liens were asserted against us, we would have had to evaluate it at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument today. It has been very helpful to us. Your case has now been submitted, and we're going to take a recess. But before we do, I wanted to tell you that there's a group in the courtroom today. ICANN Homeschool is here with some students that have attended and listened to your argument as well. And the justices are going to go back into the conference room and begin our conference. But the students might have some questions for you, and you are free to answer those questions. If you want to, you're free not to. It's up to you as to whether or not you want to do that. We will come back after you're finished, so they could ask you questions about the case if they wanted to. But when we come back to answer their questions, they're not going to ask us any questions about this case, and we're not going to answer any questions about this case. So I wanted to make that clear to you as well, because they're going to do a tour afterwards as well. But we will not be discussing this case. So we're going to adjourn now, and we thank you very much for being here.
Yes, I'm going to do the thing.